cleared area only a few hundred yards below the gates of Bryn Shander, and he felt the supernatural aura of the powerful magic he had earlier sensed, like the living heart of some unknown life form pulsating in the demon's clawed hands. Goblins gathered around to watch the spectacle, keeping a respectable distance between them and Kessel's dangerously unpredictable captain.
"What is that?"
asked Regis, crushed in among the watching throng on Bryn Shander's wall.
"A demon," Cassius answered. "A big one."
"It mocks our meager defenses," Glenn Sather cried. "How can we hope to stand against such a foe?"
The demon bent low, involved in the ritual to call out the Dwyomer of the crystalline object. It stood the crystal shard upright on the grass and stepped back, bellowing forth the obscure words of an ancient spell, rising to a crescendo as the sky began to brighten with the sun's imminent appearance.
"A glass dagger?"
Regis asked, puzzled by the pulsating object. Then the first ray of dawn broke the horizon. The crystal sparkled and summoned the light, bending the sunbeam's path and absorbing its energy. The shard flared again, the pulsations intensified as more of the sun crept into the eastern sky, only to have its light sucked into the hungry image of Crenshinabon. The spectators on the wall gaped in horror, wondering if Akar Kessel held power over the sun itself. Only Cassius had the presence of mind to connect the power of the shard with the light of the sun. Then the crystal began to grow. It swelled as each pulse attained its peak, then shrank back a bit while the next throb grew. Everything around it remained in shadow, for it greedily consumed all the sunlight. Slowly, but inevitably, its girth widened and its tip rose high into the air. The people on the wall and the monsters on the field had to avert their eyes from the brightened power of Kryshal Tirith. Only the drow from his distant vantage point and the demon, who was immune to such sights, witnessed another image of Crenshinabon being raised. The third Kryshal Tirith grew to life. The tower released its hold on the sun as the ritual was completed, and all the region was bathed in morning sunlight. The demon roared at its successful spellcasting and strode proudly into the new tower's mirrored doorway, followed by the trolls, the wizard's personal guard. The besieged inhabitants of Bryn Shander and Targos looked upon the incredible structure with a confused mixture of awe, appreciation, and terror. They could not resist the unearthly beauty of Kryshal Tirith, but they knew the consequences of the tower's appearance. Akar Kessel, master of goblins and giants, had come. Goblins and orcs fell to their knees, and all the vast army took up the chant of "Kessel! Kessel!" paying homage to the wizard with a fanatical devotion that brought shivers to the human witnesses to the spectacle. Drizzt, too, was unnerved by the extent of the influence and devotion the wizard exerted over the normally independent goblin tribes. The drow determined at that moment that the only chance for survival for the people of Ten Towns lay in the death of Akar Kessel. He knew even before he had considered any of the possible options that he would try to get to the wizard. For now, though, he needed to rest. He found a shadowed hole just back from the face of Kelvin's cairn and let his exhaustion overtake him. Cassius was also tired. The spokesman had stayed on the wall throughout the cold night, examining the campsites to determine how much of the natural enmity between the unruly tribes remained. He had seen some minor discord and name-calling, but nothing extreme enough to give him hope that the army would fall apart early into the siege. He couldn't understand how the wizard had achieved such a dramatic unification of the arch-foes. The appearance of the demon and the raising of Kryshal Tirith had shown him the incredible power that Kessel commanded. He had soon drawn the same conclusions as the drow. Unlike Drizzt, though, the spokesman from Bryn Shander did not retire when the field calmed again, despite the protests of Regis and Glenn Sather concerned for his health. On his shoulders, Cassius carried the responsibility for the several thousand terrified people that lay huddled within his city's walls, and there would be no rest for him.
He needed information. He needed to find a weak link in the wizard's seemingly impregnable armor. And so the spokesman watched diligently and patiently throughout the first long, uneventful day of the siege, noting the boundaries that the goblin tribes staked out as their own, and the order of hierarchy that determined the distance of each group from the center spot of Kryshal Tirith. Away to the east, the fleets of Kaer Konig and Kaer Dinaval moored alongside the docks of the deserted city of Easthaven. Several crews had gone ashore to gather supplies, but most of the people had remained on the boats, unsure of how far east Kessel's black arm extended. Jensen Brent and his counterpart from Kaer Konig had taken full control of their immediate situation from the decks of the Mistseeker, the flagship of Kaer Dinaval. All disputes between the two cities had been called off, temporarily at least, though promises of continued friendship were heard on the decks of every ship on Lac Dinashir. Both spokesmen were agreed that they would not yet leave the waters of the lake and flee, for they realized that they had nowhere to go. All of the 10 towns were threatened by Kessel, and Luskin was fully 400 miles away and across the path of Kessel's army. The ill-equipped refugees couldn't hope to reach it before the first of winter's snows caught up with them. The sailors that had disembarked soon returned to the docks with the welcome news that Easthaven had not yet been touched by the darkness. More crews were ordered ashore to collect extra food and blankets, but Jensen Brent played it cautiously, thinking it wise to keep most of the refugees out on the water beyond Kessel's reach. More promising news came a short time later.
"Signals from Redwater, Spokesman Brent,"
the watchman atop the Mistseeker's crow's nest called out.
"The people of Goodmead and Dugan's Hole are unharmed."
He held up his newsbearer, a small glass piece crafted in tourmaline and designed to focus the light of the sun for signaling across the lakes, using intricate, though limited, signaling codes.
"My calls have been answered."
"Where are they, then?"
Brent asked excitedly.
"On the eastern banks," the watchman replied. "They sailed out of their villages, thinking them undefendable. None of the monsters have yet approached, but the spokesman felt that the far side of the lake would be safer until the invaders have departed."
"Keep the communication open," Brent ordered. "Let me know when you have more news."
"Until the invaders have departed," Shermont echoed incredulously as he moved to Jensen Brent's side.
"A foolishly hopeful assessment of the situation, I agree," said Brent. "But I am relieved that our cousins to the south yet live."
"Do we go to them? Join our forces?"
"Not yet," answered Brent. "I fear that we would be too vulnerable on the open ground between the lakes. We need more information before we can take any effective action. Let us keep the communications flowing between the two lakes, gather volunteers to carry messages to Redwaters."
"They shall be sent off immediately,"
agreed Shermont as he headed away. Brent nodded and looked back across the lake at the dying plume of smoke above his home.
"More information," he muttered to himself.
Other volunteers headed out later that day into the more treacherous west to scout out the situation in the principal city. Brent and Shermont had done a masterful job in quelling the panic, but even with the substantial gains in organization, the initial shock of the sudden and deadly invasion had left most of the survivors of Kaer Konig and Kaer Dinaval in a state of utter despair. Jensen Brent was the glowing exception. The spokesman from Kaer Dinaval was a courageous fighter who steadfastly refused to yield until the last breath had left his body. He sailed his proud flagship around the moorings of the others, rallying the people with his cries of promised revenge against Akar Kessel. Now he watched and waited on the Mistseeker for the critical news from the west. In mid-afternoon he heard the call he had prayed for.
"She stands!"
the watcher on the crow's nest cried out ecstatically when the newsbearer's signal flashed in.
"Bryn Shander stands!"
Suddenly, Brent's optimism took on credibility. The miserable band of homeless victims assumed an angry posture bent on vengeance. More messengers were dispatched at once to carry the news to Redwaters that Kessel hadn't yet achieved complete victory. On both lakes, the task of separating the warriors from the civilians soon began in earnest, with the women and children moving to the heaviest and least seaworthy boats, and the fighting men boarding the fastest vessels. The designated warships were then moved to the outbound moorings, where they could put out quickly across the lakes. Their sails were checked and tightened in preparation for the wild run that would carry their brave crews to war. Or, by Jensen Brent's furious decree, the run that would carry their brave crews to victory! Regis had rejoined Cassius on the wall when the newsbearer's signal had been spotted on the southwestern banks of Lac Dinashir. The halfling had slept for most of the night and day, figuring that he might as well die doing the thing he loved to do best. He was surprised when he awakened, expecting his slumber to last into eternity. Cassius was beginning to view things a bit differently, though. He had compiled a long list of potential breakdowns in Akkar Kessel's unruly army, orcs bullying goblins, and giants in turn bullying both. If he could only find a way for them to hold out long enough for the obvious hatred between the goblin races to take its toll on Kessel's force. And then, the signal from Lac Dinashir and subsequent reports of similar flashes on the far side of Redwaters had given the spokesman sincere hope that the siege might well disintegrate and Ten Towns survive. But then the wizard made his dramatic appearance, and Cassius's hopes were dashed. It began as a pulse of red light circling within the glassy wall at the base of Kryshal Tirith. Then a second pulse, this one blue, started up the tower, rotating in the opposite direction. Slowly they circled the diameter of the tower, blending into green as they converged, then separating and continuing on their way. All who could see the tantalizing show stared apprehensively, unsure of what would happen next, but convinced that a display of tremendous power was forthcoming. The circling lights speeded up, their intensity increasing with their velocity. Soon the entire base of the tower was ringed in a green blur, so bright that the onlookers had to avert their eyes. And out of the blur stepped two hideous trolls, each bearing an ornate mirror. The light slowed and stopped altogether. The mere sight of the disgusting trolls filled the people of Bryn Shander with revulsion, but intrigued, no one would turn away. The monsters walked right to the base of the city's sloping hill and stood facing each other, aiming their mirrors diagonally toward each other, but still catching the reflection of Kryshal Tirith. Twin beams of light shot down from the tower, each one striking one of the mirrors and converging with the other halfway between the trolls. A sudden pulse from the tower, like the flash of a lightning stroke, left the area between the monsters veiled in smoke, and when it cleared, instead of the converging beams of light, stood a thin, crooked shell of a man in a red, satiny robe. Goblins fell to their knees again and hid their faces in the ground. Akkar Kessel had come. He looked up in the direction of Cassius on the wall, a cocky smile stretched across his thin lips.
"Greetings, spokesman of Bryn Shander," he cackled. "Welcome to my fair city," he laughed wryly.
Cassius had no doubt that the wizard had picked him out, though he had no recollection of ever seeing the man and didn't understand how he had been recognized. He looked to Regis and Glenn Sather for an explanation, but they both shrugged their shoulders.
"Yes, I know you, Cassius," Kessel said. "And to you, good spokesman Glenn Sather, my greetings. I should have guessed that you would be here. Ever were the people of Easthaven willing to join in a cause, no matter how hopeless."
Now it was Glenn Sather's turn to stare dumbfounded at his companions. But again, there were no explanations forthcoming.
"You know of us," Cassius replied to the apparition. "Yet you are unknown to us. It seems that you hold an unfair advantage."
"Unfair?" protested the wizard. "I hold every advantage, foolish man."
Again the laugh.
"You know of me. At least Glenn Sather does."
The spokesman from Easthaven shrugged his shoulders again in reply to Cassius's inquiring glance. The gesture seemed to anger Kessel.
"I spent several months living in Easthaven," the wizard snapped, "in the guise of a wizard's apprentice from Luskin. Clever, don't you agree?"
"Do you remember him?" Cassius asked Glenn Sather softly.
It could be of great import.
It is possible that he stayed in East Haven, Glenn Sather replied in the same whispered tones, though no group from the Host Tower has come into my city for several years. Yet we are an open city, and many foreigners arrive with every passing trading caravan.
I tell you the truth, Cassius, I have no recollection of the man.
Kessel was outraged. He stamped his foot impatiently, and the smile on his face was replaced by a pouting pucker.
Perhaps my return to Ten Towns will prove more memorable, fools, he snapped. He held his arms outstretched in self-important proclamation. Behold, Akar Kessel, the tyrant of Icewind Dale, he cried. People of Ten Towns, your master has come.
Your words are a bit premature, Cassius began,
but Kessel cut him short with a frenzied scream.
Never interrupt me!
The wizard shouted, the veins in his neck taut and bulging, and his face turning as red as blood. Then, as Cassius quieted in disbelief, Kessel seemed to regain a measure of his composure.
You shall learn better, proud Cassius, he threatened. You shall learn!
He turned back to Kryshal Tirith and uttered a simple word of command. The tower went black for a moment, as though it refused to release the reflections of the sun's light. Then it began to glow far within its depths, with a light that seemed more its own than a reflection of the day. With each passing second, the hue shifted, and the light began to climb and circle the strange walls.
Behold, Akar Kessel! The wizard proclaimed, still frowning. Look upon the splendor of Kren Shinabon and surrender all hope!
More lights began flashing within the tower's walls, climbing and dropping randomly, and spinning about the structure in a frenzied dance that cried out for release. Gradually, they were working their way up to the pointed pinnacle, and it began to flare as if on fire, shifting through the colors of the spectrum until its white flame rivaled the brightness of the sun itself. Kessel cried out as a man in ecstasy. The fire was released. It shot out in a thin, searing line northward toward the unfortunate city of Targos. Many spectators lined Targos' high wall, though the tower was much farther away from them than it was from Bryn Shander, and it appeared as no more than a flashing speck on the distant plain. They had little idea of what was happening beneath the principal city, though they did see the ray of fire coming toward them. But by then, it was too late. The wrath of Akar Kessel roared into the proud city, cutting a swath of instant devastation. Fires sprouted all along its killing line. People caught in the direct path never even had a chance to cry out before they were simply vaporized. But those who survived the initial attack, women and children and tundra-toughened men alike, who had faced death a thousand times and more, did scream. And their wails carried out across the still lake to Lonelywood and Bremen, to the cheering goblins in Termalane, and down the plain to the horrified witnesses in Bryn Shander. Kessel waved his hand and slightly altered the angle of the release, thus arcing the destruction throughout Targos. Every major structure within the city was soon burning, and hundreds of people lay dead or dying, pitifully rolling about on the ground to extinguish the flames that engulfed their bodies, or gasping helplessly in a desperate search for air in the heavy smoke. Kessel reveled in the moment. But then he felt an involuntary shudder rack his spine, and the tower too seemed to quiver. The wizard clutched at the relic, still tucked under the folds of his robe. He understood that he had pushed the limits of Kren Shinabon's strength too far. Back in the spine of the world, the first tower that Kessel had raised crumbled into rubble, and far out on the open tundra, the second did likewise. The shard pulled in its borders, destroying the tower images that sapped away its strength. Kessel, too, had been wearied by the effort, and the lights of the remaining Kryshal Tirith began to calm and then to wane. The ray fluttered and died. But it had finished its business. When the invasion had first come, Kemp and the other proud leaders of Targos had promised their people that they would hold the city until the last man had fallen. But even the stubborn spokesman realized that they had no choice but to flee. Luckily, the city proper, which had taken the brunt of Kessel's attack, was on high ground overlooking the sheltered bay area. The fleets remained unharmed, and the homeless fishermen of Termalane were already on the docks, having stayed with their boats after they had docked in Targos.
As soon as they had realized the unbelievable extent of the destruction that was occurring in the city proper, they began preparing for the imminent influx of the war's latest refugees. Most of the boats of both cities sailed out within minutes of the attack, desperate to get their vulnerable sails safely away from the wind-blown sparks and debris. A few vessels remained behind, braving the growing hazards to rescue any later arrivals on the docks. The people on Bryn Shander's dock wept at the continued screams of the dying. Cassius, though, consumed by his quest to seek out and understand the apparent weaknesses that Kessel had just revealed, had no time for tears. In truth, the cries affected him as deeply as anyone, but unwilling to let the lunatic Kessel view any hints of weakness from him, he transformed his visage from sorrow to an iron grimace of rage. Kessel laughed at him.
"Do not pout, poor Cassius," the wizard taunted. "It is unbecoming." "You are a dog," Glenn Sather retorted, "and unruly dogs should be beaten."
Cassius stayed his fellow spokesman with an outstretched hand.
"Be calm, my friend," he whispered. "Kessel will feed off of our panic. Let him talk. He reveals more to us than he believes."
"Poor Cassius,"
Kessel repeated sarcastically. Then suddenly, the wizard's face twisted in outrage. Cassius noted the abrupt swing keenly, filing it away with the other information he had collected.
"Mark well what you have witnessed here, people of Bryn Shander," Kessel sneered. "Bow to your master, or the same fate shall befall you. And there is no water behind you. You have nowhere to run."
He laughed wildly again and looked all about the city's hill, as though he was searching for something.
"What are you to do?" he cackled. "You have no lake." "I have spoken, Cassius. Hear me well. You will deliver an emissary unto me tomorrow, an emissary to bear the news of your unconditional surrender. And if your pride prevents such an act, remember the cries of dying Targos. Look to the city on the banks of Mare de Walden for guidance, pitiful Cassius. The fire shall not have died when the morrow dawns."
Just then, a courier raced up to the spokesman.
"Many ships have been spotted moving out from under the blanket of smoke in Targos. Newsbearer signals have already begun coming in from the refugees."
"And what of Kemp?" Cassius asked anxiously.
"He lives,"
the courier answered,
"and he has vowed revenge."
Cassius breathed a sigh of relief. He wasn't overly fond of his peer from Targos, but he knew that the battle-seasoned spokesman would prove a valuable asset to Tentown's cause before all was through. Kessel heard the conversation and growled in disdain.
"And where shall they run?" he asked Cassius.
The spokesman, intent on studying this unpredictable and unbalanced adversary, did not reply, but Kessel answered the question for him.
"To Bremen? But they cannot!"
He snapped his fingers, beginning the chain of a prearranged message to his westernmost forces. At once, a large group of goblins broke rank and started out to the west, toward Bremen.
"You see? Bremen falls before the night is through, and yet another fleet will scurry out onto their precious lake. The scene shall be repeated in the town in the wood with predictable results. But what protection will the lakes offer these people when the merciless winter begins to fall?" he shouted. "How fast shall their ships sail away from me when the waters are frozen around them?"
He laughed again, but this time more seriously, more dangerously.
"What protection do any of you have against Akar Kessel?"
Cassius and the wizard held each other in unyielding glares. The wizard barely mouthed the words, but Cassius heard him clearly.
"What protection?"
Out on Mare de Walden, Kemp bit back his frustrated rage as he watched his city tumble in flames. Soot-blackened faces stared back to the burning ruins in horrified disbelief, shouting impossible denials and openly crying for their lost friends and kin. But like Cassius, Kemp converted his despair into constructive anger. As soon as he learned of the goblin force departing for Bremen, he dispatched his fastest ship to warn the people of that distant city and to inform them of the happenings across the lake. Then he sent a second ship toward Lonelywood to beg for food and bandages, and perhaps an invitation to dock.
Despite their obvious differences, the spokesmen of the 10 towns were in many ways alike. Like a Gorwell, who had been happy to sacrifice everything for the good of the people, and Jensen Brent, who refused to yield to despair, Kemp of Targos set about rallying his people for a retaliatory strike. He didn't yet know how he would accomplish the feat, but he knew that he had not had his final say in the Wizard's War. And poised upon the wall of Bryn Shander, Cassius knew it too.
25. Ertu.
Drizzt crawled out of his hidden chamber as the last lights of the setting sun began fading away. He scanned the southern horizon and was again dismayed. He had needed to rest, but he couldn't help feeling pangs of guilt when he saw the city of Targos burning, as though he had neglected his duty to bear witness to the suffering of Kessel's helpless victims. Yet the drow had not been idle, even during the hours of the meditative trance the elves called sleep. He had journeyed back into the underworld of his distant memories in search of a particular sensation, the aura of a powerful presence he had once known. Though he had not gotten close enough for a good look at the demon he had followed the previous night, something about the creature had struck a familiar chord in his oldest recollections. A pervading, unnatural emanation surrounded creatures from the lower planes when they walked on the material world, an aura that the Dark Elves, more so than any other race, had come to understand and recognize. Not only this type of demon, but this particular creature itself was known to Drizzt. It had served his people in Menzo Baranzon for many years. "Ertu," he whispered, as he sorted through his dreams. Drizzt knew the demon's true name. It would come to his call. The search to find an appropriate spot from which he could call the demon took Drizzt over an hour, and he spent several more preparing the area. His goal was to take away as many of Ertu's advantages, size and flight in particular, as he could, though he sincerely hoped that their meeting would not involve combat. People who knew the drow considered him daring, sometimes even reckless, but that was against mortal enemies who would recoil from the stinging pain of his whirring blades. Demons, especially one of Ertu's size and strength, were a different story altogether. Many times during his youth, Drizzt had witnessed the wrath of such a monster. He had seen buildings thrown down, solid stone torn by the great clawed hands. He had seen mighty human warriors strike the monster with blows that would fell an ogre, only to find in their dying horror that their weapons were useless against such a powerful being from the lower planes. His own people usually fared better against demons, actually receiving a measure of respect from them. Demons often allied with drow on even terms, or even served the Dark Elves outright, for they were wary of the powerful weapons and magic the drow possessed. But that was back in the underworld, where the strange emanations from the unique stone formations blessed the metals used by the drow craftsmen with mysterious and magical properties. Drizzt had none of the weapons from his homeland, for their strange magic could not withstand the light of day. Though he had been careful to keep them protected from the sun, they became useless shortly after he moved to the surface. He doubted that the weapons he now carried would be able to harm Ertu at all. And even if they did, demons of Ertu's stature could not be truly destroyed away from their native planes. If it came to blows, the most that Drizzt could hope to do was banish the creature from the material plane for 100 years. He had no intentions of fighting. Yet he had to try something against the wizard who threatened the towns. His goal now was to gain some knowledge that might reveal a weakness in the wizard, and his method was deception and disguise, hoping that Ertu remembered enough about the Dark Elves to make his story credible, yet not too much to strip away the flimsy lies that would hold it together. The place he had chosen for the meeting was a sheltered dell a few yards from the mountain's cliff face. A pinnacled roof formed by converging walls covered half of the area. The other half was open to the sky, but the entire place was set back into the mountainside behind high walls, safely out of view of Kryshal Tirith. Now Drizzt worked with a dagger, scraping runes of warding on the walls and floor in front of where he would sit. His mental image of these magical symbols had fuzzied over the many years, and he knew that their design was far from perfect. Yet he realized that he would need any possible protection that they might offer if Ertu turned on him. When he was finished, he sat cross-legged under the roofed section, behind the protected area, and tossed out the small statuette that he carried in his pack. Guinevar would be a good test for his warding inscriptions. The great cat answered the summons. It appeared in the other side of the cubby, its keen eyes scanning the area for any potential danger that threatened its master. Then, sensing nothing, it turned a curious glance on Drizzt.
"Come to me," Drizzt called, beckoning with his hand.
The cat strode toward him, then stopped abruptly, as though it had walked into a wall. Drizzt sighed in relief when he saw that his runes held some measure of strength. His confidence was bolstered considerably, though he realized that Ertu would push the power of the runes to their absolute limits and probably beyond. Guinevar lolled its huge head in an effort to understand what had deterred it. The resistance hadn't really been very strong, but the mixed signals from its master, calling for it yet warding it away, had confused the cat. It considered gathering its strength and walking right through the feeble barrier, but its master seemed pleased that it had stopped. So the cat sat where it was and waited. Drizzt was busy studying the area, searching out the optimum place for Guinevar to spring from and surprise the demon. A deep ledge on one of the high walls just beyond the portion that converged into a roof seemed to offer the best concealment. He motioned the cat into position and instructed it not to attack until his signal. Then he sat back and tried to relax, intent on his final mental preparations before he called the demon. Across the valley in the magical tower, Ertu crouched in a shadowy corner of Kessel's harem room, keeping its ever-vigilant guard over the evil wizard at play with his mindless girls. A seething fire of hatred burned in Ertu's eyes as it looked upon the foolish Kessel. The wizard had nearly ruined everything with his show of power that afternoon and his refusal to tear down the vacated towers behind him, further draining Crenshinabon's strength. Ertu had been grimly satisfied when Kessel had come back into the Kryshal Tirith and confirmed, through the use of scrying mirrors, that the other two towers had fallen to pieces. Ertu had warned Kessel against raising a third tower, but the wizard, frail of ego, had grown more stubborn with each passing day of the campaign, envisioning the demons or even Crenshinabon's advice as a ploy to undermine his absolute control. And so Ertu was quite receptive, even relieved, when it heard Drizzt's call floating down the valley. At first it denied the possibility of such a summons, but the inflections of its true name being spoken aloud sent involuntary shudders running along the demon's spine. More intrigued than angered at the impertinence of some mortal daring to utter its name, Ertu slipped away from the distracted wizard and moved outside Kryshal Tirith. Then the call came again, cutting through the harmony of the wind's endless song like a white-capped wave on a still pond. Ertu spread its great wings and soared northward over the plain, speeding toward the summoner. Terrified goblins fled from the darkness of the demon's passing shadow, for even in the faint glimmer of a thin moon, the creature of the abyss left a wake of blackness that made the night seem bright in comparison. Drizzt sucked in a tense breath. He sensed the unerring approach of the demon as it veered away from Bremen's run and swept upward over the lower slopes of Kelvin's cairn. Guinevar lifted its head off its paws and growled, also sensing the approach of the evil monster. The cat ducked to the very back of the deep ledge and lay flat and still, awaiting its master's command, confident that its heightened abilities of stealth could protect it even against the highly tuned senses of a demon. Ertu's leathery wings folded up tight as it alighted on the ledge. It immediately pinpointed the exact location of the summoner, and though it had to tuck its broad shoulders to pass through the narrow entrance to the dell, it charged straight in, intent on appeasing its curiosity, and then killing the blasphemous fool that dared utter its name aloud. Drizzt fought to hold his edge of control when the huge demon pushed in, its bulk filling the small area beyond his tiny sanctuary, blocking out the starlight before him.
There could be no turning back from his dangerous course. He had no place to run. The demon stopped suddenly in amazement. It had been centuries since Ertu had looked upon a drow, and it certainly never expected to find one on the surface, in the frozen wastelands of the farthest north. Somehow, Drizzt found his voice. "Greetings, Master of Chaos," he said calmly, bowing low. "I am Drizzt O'Erden, of the House of Daermon and Eshesbernon, ninth family to the throne of Menzo Berenzon. Welcome to my humble camp."
"You're a long way from home, drow," the demon said with obvious suspicion.
"As are thee, great demon of the abyss," Drizzt replied coolly. "And lured to this high corner of the world for similar reasons, unless I miss my guess."
"I know why I am here," answered Ertu. "The business of the drow has ever been outside my understanding or caring."
Drizzt stroked his slender chin and chuckled in feigned confidence. His stomach was tied in knots, and he felt the beginnings of a cold sweat coming on. He chuckled again and fought against the fear. If the demon sensed his unease, his credibility would be greatly diminished. Ah, but this time, for the first time in many years, it seems that the roads of our business have crossed, mighty purveyor of destruction. "My people have a curiosity, perhaps even a vested interest, in the wizard that you apparently serve." Ertu squared its shoulders, the first flickers of a dangerous flame evident in its red eyes.
"Serve?"
it echoed incredulously, the even tone of its voice quivering, as though it bordered on the edge of an uncontrollable rage. Drizzt was quick to qualify his observation. "By all appearances, guardian of chaotic intentions, the wizard holds some power over you. Surely you work alongside Akar Kessel."
"I serve no human," Ertu
roared, shaking the cave's very foundation with an emphatic stamp of its foot. Drizzt wondered if the fight that he could not hope to win was about to begin. He considered calling out Guinevar so that they could at least land the first blows. But the demon suddenly calmed again. Convinced that it had half-guessed the reason for the unexpected presence of the drow, Ertu turned a scrutinizing eye on Drizzt.
"Serve the wizard?" it laughed. "Akar Kessel is puny, even by the low standards of humans. But you know this drow, and do not dare to deny it. You are here, as I am here, for Kryn Shinabon, and Kessel be damned."
The confused look on Drizzt's face was genuine enough to throw Ertu off balance. The demon still believed that it had guessed correctly, but it couldn't understand why the drow didn't comprehend the name.
"Kryn Shinabon,"
it explained, sweeping its clawed hand to the south.
"An ancient bastion of unspeakable power."
"The tower?" Drizzt asked. Ertu's uncertainty bubbled up in the form of explosive fury.
"Play no games of ignorance with me," the demon bellowed. "The drow lords know well the power of Akar Kessel's artifact, or else they would not have come to the surface to seek it out."
"Very well. You've guessed at the truth," Drizzt conceded. "Yet I had to be certain that the tower on the plain was indeed the ancient artifact that I seek. My masters show little mercy to careless spies." Ertu smiled wickedly as it remembered the unholy torture chambers of Menzo Berenzon. Those years it had spent among the Dark Elves had been enjoyable indeed. Drizzt quickly pressed the conversation in a direction that might reveal some weaknesses of Kessel or his tower. "One thing has kept me puzzled, awesome specter of unbridled evil," he began, careful to continue his string of unduplicated compliments. "By what right does this wizard possess Kryn Shinabon?"
"None at all," Ertu said. "Wizard, bah! measured against your own people. He is barely an apprentice. His tongue twitches uneasily when he utters even the simplest of spells. But fate often plays such games. And more to the enjoyment, I say, let Akar Kessel have his brief moment of triumph. Humans do not live a very long time.
Drizzt knew that he was pursuing a dangerous line of questions, but he accepted the risk. Even with a major demon standing barely 10 feet away, Drizzt figured that his chances for survival at this moment were better than those of his friends in Bryn Shander.
Still, my masters are concerned that the tower may be harmed in the coming battle with the humans, he bluffed.
Ertu took another moment to consider Drizzt. The appearance of the Dark Elves complicated the demon's simple plan to inherit Kren Shinnabon from Kessel. If the mighty drow lords of the huge city of Menzo Berenzon truly had designs upon the relic, the demon knew that they would get it. Certainly Kessel, even with the power of the shard behind him, could not withstand them. The mere presence of this drow changed the demon's perceptions of its relationship with Kren Shinnabon. How Ertu wished that it could simply devour Kessel and flee with the relic before the Dark Elves were too involved. Yet Ertu had never considered the drow as enemies, and the demon had come to despise the bumbling wizard. Perhaps an alliance with the Dark Elves could prove beneficial to both sides.
Tell me, unequaled champion of darkness, Drizzt pressed, is Kren Shinnabon in peril?
Bah! Snorted Ertu. Even the tower that is merely a reflection of Kren Shinnabon is impervious. It absorbs all attacks directed against its mirrored walls and reflects them back on their source. Only the pulsating crystal of strength, the very heart of Kryshal Tirith, is vulnerable, and that is safely hidden away.
Inside?
Of course.
But if someone were to get into the tower, Drizzt reasoned, how well protected would he then find the heart?
An impossible task, the demon replied. Unless the simple fishermen of 10 towns have some spirit at their service. Or perhaps a high priest or an archmage to weave spells of unveiling. Surely your masters know that Kryshal Tirith's door is invisible and undetectable to any beings inherent to the present plane the tower rests upon. No creature of this material world, your race included, could find its way in.
But, Drizzt pressed anxiously, ere to cut him short.
Even if someone stumbled into the structure,
he growled, impatient with the relentless stream of impossible suppositions.
He would have to pass by me, and the limits of Kessel's power within the tower is considerable indeed, for the wizard has become an extension of Kren Shinnabon itself, a living outlet for the crystal shard's unfathomable strength. The heart lies beyond the very focal point of Kessel's interaction with the tower, and up to the very tip.
The demon stopped, suddenly suspicious of Drizzt's line of questioning. If the lore-wise drow lords were truly intent upon Kren Shinnabon, why weren't they more aware of its strengths and weaknesses? Ertu understood its mistake then. It examined Drizzt once again, but with a different focus. When it had first encountered the drow, stunned by the mere presence of a dark elf in this region, it had searched for deception in the physical attributes of Drizzt himself to determine if his drow features were an illusion, a clever yet simple shape alteration trick within the power of even a minor mage. When Ertu was convinced that a true drow and no illusion stood before it, it had accepted the credibility of Drizzt's story as consistent with the characteristics of the Dark Elves' style. Now, though, the demon scoured the peripheral clues beyond Drizzt's black skin, noting the items he carried and the area he had staked out for their meeting.
Nothing that Drizzt had upon his person, not even the weapons sheathed on his hips, emanated the distinct magical properties of the underworld. Perhaps the Drow masters had outfitted their spies more appropriately for the surface world, Ertu reasoned. From what it had learned of the Dark Elves during its many years of service in Menzo Berenzon, this Drow's presence was certainly not outrageous. But creatures of chaos survived by trusting no one. Ertu continued his scan for a clue of Drizzt's authenticity. The only item the demon had spotted that reflected on Drizzt's heritage was a thin silver chain strung around his slender neck, a piece of jewelry common among the Dark Elves for holding a small pouch of wealth. Concentrating upon this, Ertu discovered a second chain, finer than the first, weaving in and out of the other. The demon followed the almost imperceptible crease in Drizzt's jerkin created by the long chain. Unusual, it noted, and possibly revealing. Ertu pointed at the chain, spoke a command word, and raised its outstretched finger into the air. Drizzt tensed when he felt the emblem slipping up from under his leather jerkin. It passed up over the neckline of the garment and dropped to the extent of the chain hanging openly upon his chest. Ertu's evil grin widened along with its squinting eyes.
"Unusual choice for a drow,"
it hissed sarcastically.
"I would have expected the symbol of Loth, demon queen of your people. She would not be pleased."
From nowhere, it seemed, a many-thonged whip appeared in one of the demon's hands and a jagged, cruelly notched blade in the other. At first, Drizzt's mind whirled down 100 avenues, exploring the most feasible lies he could spin to get him out of this fix. But then he shook his head resolutely and pushed the lies away. He would not dishonor his deity. At the end of the silver chain hung a gift from Regis, a carving the halfling had done from the bone of one of the few knuckleheads he had ever hooked. Drizzt had been deeply touched when Regis presented it to him, and he considered it the halfling's finest work. It twirled around on the long chain, its gentle grades and shading giving it the depth of a true work of art. It was a white unicorn head, the symbol of the goddess, Mieliki.
"Who are you, drow?" Ertu demanded.
The demon had already decided that it would have to kill Drizzt, but it was intrigued by such an unusual meeting. A dark elf that followed the Lady of the Forest, and a surface dweller as well. Ertu had known many drow over the centuries, but had never even heard of one that had abandoned the drow's wicked ways. Cold-hearted killers, one and all, that had taught even the great demon of chaos a trick or two concerning the methods of excruciating torture.
"I am Drizzt O'Erden. That much is true," Drizzt replied evenly. "He who forsook the house of Daemon Eneshezbirnon."
All fear had flown from Drizzt when he accepted beyond any hope that he would have to battle the demon. Now he assumed the calm readiness of a seasoned fighter, prepared to seize any advantage that might fall his way.
"A ranger, humbly serving Gueron Winstrom, hero of the goddess Mieliki."
He bowed low in accordance with a proper introduction. As he straightened, he drew his scimitars.
"I must defeat you, scar of vileness," he declared, "and send you back to the swirling clouds of the bottomless abyss. There is no place in the sunlit world for one of your kind."
"You are confused, elf," the demon said. "You have lost the way of your heritage, and now you dare to presume that you might defeat me?"
Flames sprang to life from the stone wall all around Ertu.
"I would have killed you mercifully with one clean stroke out of respect for your kin. But your pride distresses me. I shall teach you to desire death. Come, feel the sting of my fire."
Drizzt was already nearly overwhelmed by the heat of Ertu's demon fire, and the brightness of the flames stung his sensitive eyes, so that the bulk of the demon seemed only the dulled blur of a shadow.
He saw the darkness extend to the demon's right and knew that Ertu had raised its terrible sword. He moved to defend, but suddenly the demon lurched to the side and roared in surprise and outrage. Guinevar had latched firmly onto its upraised arm. The huge demon held the panther at arm's length, trying to pin the cat between its forearm and the rock wall to keep the tearing claws and teeth away from a vital area. Guinevar gnawed and raked the massive arm, tearing demon flesh and muscle. Ertu winced away the vicious attack and determined to deal with the cat later. The demon's main concern remained the drow, for it respected the potential power of any of the dark elves. Ertu had seen too many foes fall beneath one of the dark elves' countless tricks. The many-thonged whip lashed out at Drizzt's legs, too quickly for the drow, still reeling from the sudden burst of brightness of the flames, to deflect the blow or dodge aside. Ertu jerked the handle as the thongs tangled about the slender legs and ankles, the demon's great strength easily dropping Drizzt to his back. Drizzt felt the stinging pain all through his legs, and he heard the rush of air pressed out of his lungs when he landed on the hard stone. He knew that he must react without delay, but the glare of the fire and Ertu's sudden strike had left him disoriented. He felt himself being dragged along the stone, felt the intensity of the heat increasing. He managed to lift his head just in time to view his tangled feet entering the demon fire. "And so I die," he stated flatly. But his legs did not burn. Drooling to hear the agonized screams of its helpless victim, Ertu gave a stronger tug on the whip and pulled Drizzt completely into the flames. Though he was totally immolated, the drow barely felt warmed by the fire. And then, with a final hiss of protest, the hot flames suddenly died away. Neither of the opponents understood what had happened, both assuming that the other had been responsible. Ertu struck quickly again, bringing a heavy foot down upon Drizzt's chest. It began grinding him into the stone. The drow flailed out in desperation with one weapon, but it had no effect on the otherworldly monster. Then Drizzt swung his other scimitar, the blade he had taken from the dragon's hoard. Hissing like water on fire, it entered Ertu's knee joint. The hilt of the weapon heated up when the blade tore into the demon's flesh, nearly burning Drizzt's hand. Then it grew icy cold, as though dousing Ertu's hot life force with a cold strength of its own. Drizzt understood then what had extinguished the fires. The demon gaped in blank horror, then screamed in agony. Never had it felt such a sting. It leaped back and tossed about wildly, trying to escape the weapon's terrible bite, dragging Drizzt, who could not let go of the hilt. Guinevar was thrown in the violence of the demon's rage, flying from the monster's arm to crash heavily into a wall. Drizzt eyed the wound incredulously as the demon backed away. Steam poured from the hole in Ertu's knee, and the edges of the cut were iced over. Drizzt, too, had been weakened by the strike. In its struggle with the mighty demon, the scimitar had drawn upon its wielder's life force, pulling Drizzt into the battle with a fiery monster. Now the drow felt as though he hadn't even the strength left to stand, but he found himself lunging forward, blade fully extended before him, as if pulled by the scimitar's hunger. The cubby entrance was too narrow. Ertu could neither dodge nor spring away. The scimitar found the demon's belly. The explosive surge as the blade touched the core of Ertu's life force drained away Drizzt's strength, tossing him backward. He cracked against the stone wall and crumpled, but managed to keep himself alert enough to witness the titanic struggle still raging. Ertu got out onto the ledge. The demon was staggering now, trying to spread its wings, but they drooped weakly. The scimitar glowed white with powder as it continued its assault. The demon could not bear to grasp it and tear it free, though the embedded blade, its magic quenching the fires it had been wrought to destroy, was surely winning the conflict. Ertu knew that it had been careless, overconfident in its ability to destroy any mortal in single combat. The demon hadn't considered the possibility of such a wicked blade. It had never even heard of a weapon with such a sting. Steam poured from Ertu's exposed entrails and enveloped the combatants.
"And so you have banished me, treacherous drow!"
it spat. Dazed, Drizzt watched in amazement as the white glow intensified and the black shadow diminished.
"100 years, drow!" Ertu howled. "Not such a long time for the likes of you or me!"
The vapor thickened as the shadow seemed to melt away.
A century, Drizdo Erden,
came Ertu's fading cry from somewhere far away.
Look over your shoulder, then. Ertu shall not be far behind.
The vapor wafted up into the air and was gone. The last sound Drizzt heard was the clang of the metal scimitar falling to the stone ledge. 26. Rites of Victory. Wulfgar leaned back in his chair at the head of the main table in the hastily constructed mead hall, his foot tapping nervously at the long delays necessitated by the demands of proper tradition. He felt that his people should already be on the move, but it was the restoration of the traditional ceremonies and celebrations that had immediately separated and placed him above the tyrant Hiefstag in the eyes of the skeptical and ever-suspicious barbarians. Wulfgar, after all, had walked into their midst after a 5-year absence and challenged their long-standing king. One day later, he had won the crown, and the day after that, he had been coronated King Wulfgar of the Tribe of the Elk. And he was determined that his reign, short though he intended it to be, would not be marked by the threats and bullying tactics of his predecessors. He would ask the warriors of the assembled tribes to follow him into battle, not command them. For he knew that a barbarian warrior was a man driven almost exclusively by fierce pride. Stripped of their dignity, as Hiefstag had done by refusing to honor the sovereignty of each individual king, the tribesmen were no better in battle than ordinary men. Wulfgar knew that they would need to regain their proud edge if they were to have any chance at all against the wizard's overwhelming numbers. Thus, Hengorot, the mead hall, had been raised, and the challenge of the song initiated for the first time in nearly 5 years. It was a short, happy time of good-natured competition between tribes who had been suffocated under Hiefstag's unrelenting domination. The decision to raise the Deerskin Hall had been difficult for Wulfgar. Assuming that he still had time before Kessel's army struck, he had weighed the benefits of regaining tradition against the pressing need of haste. He only hoped that in the frenzy of pre-battle preparations, Kessel would overlook the absence of the barbarian king, Hiefstag. If the wizard was at all sharp, it wasn't likely. Now he waited quietly and patiently, watching the fires return to the eyes of the tribesmen.
Like old times?
Revyak asked, sitting next to him.
Good times, Wulfgar responded.
Satisfied, Revyak leaned back against the tent's deerskin wall, granting the new chief the solitude he obviously desired. And Wulfgar resumed his wait, seeking the best moment to unveil his proposition. At the far end of the hall, an axe-throwing competition was beginning. Similar to the tactics Hiefstag and Beorg had used to seal a pact between the tribes at the last Hengorot, the challenge was to hurl an axe from as great a distance as possible and sink it deeply enough into a keg of mead to open a hole. The number of mugs that could be filled from the effort within a specified count determined the success of the throw. Wulfgar saw his chance. He leaped from his stool and demanded, by rights of being the host, the first throw. The man who had been selected to judge the challenge acknowledged Wulfgar's right and invited him to come down to the first selected distance.
From here,
Wulfgar said, hoisting Aegis Fang to his shoulder. Murmurs of disbelief and excitement arose from all corners of the hall. The use of a warhammer in such a challenge was unprecedented, but none complained or cited rules. Every man who had heard the tales, but not witnessed firsthand the splitting of Hiefstag's great axe, was anxious to see the weapon in action. A keg of mead was placed upon a stool at the back end of the hall.
Another behind it, Wulfgar demanded, and another behind that.
His concentration narrowed on the task at hand, and he didn't take the time to sort out the whispers he heard all around him. The kegs were readied, and the crowd backed out of the young king's line of sight. Wulfgar grasped Aegis Fang tightly in his hands and sucked in a great breath, holding it in to keep himself steady. The unbelieving onlookers watched in amazement as the new king exploded into movement, hurling the mighty hammer with a fluid motion and strength unmatched among their ranks.
Aegis Fang tumbled, head over handle, the length of the long hall, blasting through the first keg and then the second and beyond, taking not only the three targets in their stools, but continuing on to tear a hole in the back of the mead hall. The closest warriors hurried to the opening to watch the remainder of its flight, but the hammer had disappeared into the night. They started out to retrieve it, but Wulfgar stopped them. He sprang onto the table, lifting his arms before him.
"Hear me, warriors of the northern plains!" he cried.
Their mouths already agape at the unprecedented feat, some fell to their knees when Aegis Fang suddenly reappeared in the young king's hand.